That's what I've always admired about you, Lodge, that you did treat everybody with respect, and that's something that we need to learn and continue and carry on. We worked together in the chapter for that book of the volume six, I believe it was, or five, of the modeling systems, and we worked together, and you know, it's not a disappointment. Lodge has a way of persuading people and getting things done on time. In a book that normally would take 2-3 years, he did it in record time of 6 months. So that shows you his commitment to working and being persuasive to others, but in a very subtle and persuasive way. Well, I think we're right about on time. And our first speaker today is Dr. Dennis Timlin. He's going to be talking about some of his modeling approach and the inspiration for Lodge. So, Dennis.
Well, thanks, Robert, Ola, and Lee Wong for organizing this. And it's really a great pleasure for me to be able to present some work that has how Lodge has inspired me in my own work. And I've also always considered Lodge like both a colleague, mentor, and also a very, very good friend. So I'm thankful for being here and being able to do this. I was, after I finished my PhD about a couple of years or so later, I was looking for a postdoc position about 1989, 88 or so. And I came across an advertisement for a position in Durant, Oklahoma. And the place seemed kind of far away because I'm kind of a Northeast boy. But I saw that Lodge was the one that was offering the postdoc, and I knew him, his work from his infiltration and runoff experiments. I said, this would be a good opportunity for me to get some good experience with someone who's a good soil physicist. So I went there, and it was a small lab, and I met a really great person, Lodge, and his late wife, Nimi, both wonderful people that really welcomed me to the place and helped me get set up in research. And we traveled with Lodge. He's a great traveler, and you have to know he's also a competitive walker. So we went to San Juan to Puerto Rico, and in Puerto Rico in the hills there, and I had a really hard time keeping up with him, and I was a young guy back then. But he's very much likes to travel, and I hope he continues that later. So anyway, we had one of the works we had started there. Lodge had come up, had read this paper that was interesting. He thought it was interesting because it was this early work by Van Wiesenbeck and Kaczynowski that showed that in a row crop field that you had this spatial variation of water content, that where the water contents tend to be lower under the row of the corn plants and then higher in the mid-row positions. And Lodge thought, well, what would we do with this? How would this affect solute movement in the soil? So we would think of an experiment that we could do, to show that. And this brings up the idea of what dimensionality in our research and how we view soils and modeling of soils. And we can, you know, in a sense, dimensionality is based on what we know. There was this book written back in some time ago about called Flatland, and it's about a world where we only had two dimensions. So your status in that world was defined by how many sides you had. And very low-class people only had one side, and those the higher up in the hierarchy had like five or six sides. But they didn't know anything about three dimensions, so the whole world was two, until they came upon a cube one day. And the cube was like considered to be a being of like a god type of thing. And so that once they learned about three dimensions, their whole world changed. And I think with soils, a lot of times we focus on that one dimension of the depth profile and the depth. And especially with row crops that have that, put that kind of, they impose a kind of a spatial heterogeneity on the soils. So anyway, so we didn't have any farmland there in Durant at the lab. And Gary Heathman, who was a technician, he later became ARS scientist for Lodge, great guy, had very, very capable of doing things. He plowed up an area there, and we planted corn and soybean. And then we went, and when the corn came up, we laid it out at little plots, and we sprayed on it with some strontium bromide to see what the effect would be. So after the plants had gotten to their headings, plants had grown up and they were close to grain field stage, we cut the plants and then sampled the soil. And what we found out that yes, in the sandy soils under corn, we found that the remaining bromide was much higher concentration in the row position than in the inter-row and quarter-row position. So there was some effect that the plant had on maintaining the solid transport processes there that resulted in higher bromide concentrations. But we didn't see that effect in this, where the section of soil had more clay in it. It was a finer textured soil. And so you see that it's a very complicated process. There's a lot of things that can affect this relationship. And it would be interesting to, and so when I, after finishing in Durant, I got a position with Basil Laycock in Beltsville, Maryland, where Basil was interested in putting more mechanistic two-dimensional models, soil models, into his crop models. With Gleissem had one, but it was a very simple two-dimensional model. So I continued my work with two-dimensional, with working with with multi-dimensional work, and you know, I went to Beltsville. And so one of my interests there, I got some TDR equipment, and I was interested in looking at how, what were the dynamics of water in the row and inter-row zones between, when in this case we had a soybean crop because that's what we were working on at the time, and I instrumented it with TDR. And after this shows one of the, I did two plots, and this shows one of, and I had multiple TDRs in each plot, and this shows the results from the two plots. And you can see that with the under the row position, which actually the soil, it was reversed. In one plot, the row position had higher water contents, and the other had lower water contents. But in spite of that relative difference in water contents, the processes were the same. Whoops, I'm sorry. Me too.
By the way, turn off your phone, please. I was supposed to say that beforehand.
So early, I got that, Ed.
Didn't
it happen to some political guy once, and he answered his phone while he was giving a political speech about 2 years ago? Anyway, so the processes were this. So the processes are about the same. You see higher water uptake rates in the row zones and in each row zones, and also there's higher infiltration. Whoops. There's higher infiltration in the row zones and in the inter-row zones. And there's the complexity where the plant itself is actually capturing water in the canopy and sort of funneling it down to the row zone. And in the inter-row zones, you have the higher water uptake, so it actually gets drier. And so when I looked at the, I sort of put together sort of a summary of the data, and this is the influx. In other words, this is infiltration, and you can see the infiltration rates are higher higher in the row zone, generally higher in the row zone than in the inter-row zone, where the mean is higher here, and it's significantly different in most cases. But once you remove the plant, those differences disappear. So there's definitely a plant effect there that's doing it. In terms of water uptake, you see the same relationships. There's higher in the higher water uptake, meaning more negative. The water flux uptake is negative, so it's more negative in the row zone and the inter-row zone in most cases in these plots. And then you take the plant away, and that effect disappears. The differences are no longer significant. So there's those two things that are going on. The plant is self-funneling water to make the row zone wetter, but also the row zone dries faster, so it tends to be drier after the water has already been taken up. And how the question is how this is very complicated and how it affects the solute movement. When I was there in Beltsville with Jim Starr, and I did some work with tillage treatments and the same effect, and we noticed that with no-till, when you have residue on the soil, this higher water uptake from the plants is much less of a row inter-row effect with no-till than there is with plow-till. So not having the residue when you don't have a residue cover, the soil tends to stay drier. And the drier conditions is when you see this effect more. When the soil stays fairly wet, you don't see the effect so much. And I'm not sure if it's because of root distribution or just the fact that water is able to, you know, more mobile when it's wetter, so it tends to redistribute itself better. So one thing we looked at was another work we had done looking at preferential transport of bromide in ponded water, and we found that when you ponded the water on a very dry soil, you tend to retain more of this tracer than when you pond it when the soil is initially wet. So if the soil is initially wet and you pond a tracer on it, you get most of the tracer is going to move through the profile. If the soil is dry, not as much of it moves through the profile. And so what happened, we think, is the water is moving into the smaller pores when it's dry, and then it's kind of protected from the rapid movement in the larger pores. And this could be what's happening with the plants as well. When the soil dries with the plants, it tends to protect the solute a bit more as the solute moves into the smaller pores. So when you get those rainfalls again, the solutes don't move as much. So the next step was to investigate the dynamics. When I went to recently in Beltsville, I wanted to look more at what temperature and water component now and do it in more detail where I have more locations and more TDR probes. So we did a field experiment with corn in 2005, and Soo Kim helped us work with this, and some of this data we were collecting to validate our model MaySim. So this is partially Sue's experiment too. So here we had the corn, and we put TDR probes in at the surface right near where the plant would be. And we had some subsurface ones. So the surface ones we put in this way, and the other ones we put in sideways, deeper down the profile. And we also put thermocouples in the same places to get temperature measurements. And so the corn plants, they grew back in over the instruments, and we had a pretty good cover. And we did this, and this year Sue had a nitrogen experiment, so I want to show with what's the effect of having a crop where you have full canopy with high nitrogen and a very limited canopy with low nitrogen. So this shows what happens when you have a canopy under high nitrogen, you have full canopy, and so you tend to get the inter-row differences are not as strong because the canopy is now covering the soil and preventing it from drying. And then when you have an effect where you have no nitrogen or low nitrogen treatment, you have a less inter-row crop cover. So there's a way that the cover itself and of the plant imposes a dimensional component on the heat balance in the soil because of this effect on evaporative drying. Same thing, we saw the same thing again with more rapid water uptake in the under the plant zone with the and the plant row were kind of similar, but the inter-row, you know, you see that there's more parallel water uptake, and also the infiltration in under the plant is higher than between plants, again, because the plant capturing the flow. And that aspect of the plant capturing and funneling water is one we haven't been able to do in our models yet. It's very complex and something to look into, but it is an important process. So in 20 centimeter depth, you still see the plant with the larger canopy is then pulling water from deeper in the profile as well. So we're looking at how we model these management effects, and Sue has developed the crop part of our maize sim model, which is mechanistic and has more of a biochemical model of photosynthesis, and we use sort of a nonlinear thermal relationships instead of growing degree days. And our model was developed from SWMS2D. We got that Jurke Siemenek and Rien gave us, which is a precursor of Hydrus2D. So it was SWMS2D was a simple two-dimensional finite element, and we took components of glycine, which the root growth and the meteorological components that in terms of doing the heat balance at the surface and water evapotranspiration calculations, and also the glycine which is a soybean model of ours, had a two-dimensional root model that we incorporated into it, and we modularized it and then later connected it with the plant model that was a C in C++. So if you look at the multidimensional approaches, allow a more complex abstraction of the system. So we usually think of things as 1D, you know, just in terms of what's coming from the surface downward, but we could also look at what's going in two dimensions. And why stop at two? I mean, Hydrus2D now has three dimensions they work with, and it's really where lack of time on my part to be able to pursue more. But you can actually go into three dimensions. It probably gives you a much more complete view of things. But when you have increasing dimensionality, you get what happens, you also increase your potential error, and you have on one hand, you have to balance with the amount of more potential error that you can get from that system, and then a more complete view of the system that it gives you as well. So there's sort of two competing things there. But I think that there's really no reason with the technology we have that we can't go in these directions, because our computational technology and our ability to measure things in the soil has improved quite a bit over what it was years ago. In terms of benefits for accounting for dimensionality, variation in boundary conditions in the surface, such as fluxes of energy and matter, the varying space, can account for plant root dynamics. And the variation in the state of the system in space, such as row crops and spatial variability in soil properties, and wheel tracks and account for things like that. So, and these two interact with each other, and the modeling can help us sort of account for all these things. And that's what makes life interesting and helps us develop management practices that use more efficient use of our resources. So we use MaizeSim to investigate some interactions that show some of these data. I discussed this already. And so this is the leaf area. I just showed the leaf area at that time. We had pretty high leaf area. And this the model. We try not to calibrate MaizeSim, so this wasn't fit to any data, just using our normal parameters. So it's still a little bit low, but it gives a pretty good representation of what the LAI was. This is a simulated and observed water contents in the soil surface. You can see that especially here, we didn't quite get the water uptake. This is the simulated water uptake and the measured water uptake. And we didn't quite get the simulated water uptake was a little more than what the measured was. And it's a little bit to do with the root. The model's very sensitive to root density and things of that nature. But it captured most of the dynamics in terms of ET. A little bit higher, the predictions were lower water contents and didn't catch most of the dynamics in the subsoil, maybe due to the representation of hydraulic conductivity. All in all, it was fairly reasonable results. So if we look at row and inter-row water contents in the surface layer, you can see in the measured data, you get quite a big difference here in terms of water contents, but not in the model. And what happens is that right now the model has we've have some numerical issues with the different sizes of the elements and the mass of roots and how it goes, and we're trying to work those parts out. And I think that the root density was not simulated with the difference between the row and interrow positions at the moment. This is something I started work on this couple about a week or two ago. So, this is the reason we have these data. We're trying to test and we want to see how the model works. And you see that there are issues that have to be addressed, but we're in the right direction. These things can be done. In terms of its observed canopy temperatures before canopy closure, the model underpredicts temperature in the surface. And that's a little bit to do with the placement of the thermocouples, too, and how much you average. Thermocouples were about 5 centimeters at the surface, and the model, we tried to get that close as possible to that same measurement interval. But if you go down deep in the profile, then the temperature simulations, after the canopy closure, we get a much better results with the temperature simulations. And this is because of how the energy balance is done before and after canopy closure. So before canopy closure, you have more latent heat movement with latent heat of vaporization. And after canopy closure, most of it is in the basis of convective movement of heat due to temperature differences. And so there's another part of the model that has to be that we have to look in for improvement. But there are promising things there. So if you look at the row and interrow soil temperature, neither the model nor now this is dependent on canopy cover, again, not so much roots. So the model was pretty close to to give a pretty similar relationship to the temperatures, though you do see in the observed, you see some higher temperatures in the interrow zone during midday. And this will really relate a lot to how much the soil dries there. The question is, when you have crop cover, how much of the energy do you partition to the interrow zone? And we're still kind of working on that. Right now, we don't partition any solar energy to the interrow zone when it's complete crop cover. When in actuality, it's probably about 90%, only about 90% of the energy is really blocked. So the soil was, the soil was frequent. And this year we had 2 years of data. I'm only showing 1 year for this presentation. But the first year, the soil was frequently irrigated. So we didn't have, there wasn't a drying state where the soil was drying that would result in increased temperatures interrow. And you can see that one thing I would help to carry away is that the system is very complicated. It depends so much on what the rainfall is, how the crop cover goes, and there's a lot of things to account for. But the models can help us with this. And so the plant canopy had a significant effect on water regimes in the row and interrow zones. And there are large differences in cumulative infiltration between the two. They see more water because of the canopy there, and there was differences varied with rainfall intensities, again, because of the canopy. So the water infiltrated deeper in the row zone, the interrow zone. How this affects solid movement can be very complex, again, depending on how the solids is applied and where the nitrogen is. It can actually result in more leach in the nitrogen as well. So the incomplete canopy cover had changed the distribution of temperature and water content in the soil. And these effects can be modeled without excessive parameter fitting, so the management practices can be developed and assessed. And so our goal is really to get models that you don't have to calibrate every time, but we have to accept a certain amount of error with that. And so when the plant's actively growing, it's the boundary fluxes of evapotranspiration, infiltration, and their interaction with the plant may be more important than the boundary for the soil regime than the soil hydraulic properties themselves. In a way, plants mostly respond to what the upper level and lower level of water availability is, and they tend to also homogenize things quite a bit. So we often don't see dimensionality in plants in a field, and understanding of how this affects the plant environment can help us manage our crops better. And thank you very much for your attention. And thank you, Lush.
We have about 5 minutes for questions, so please, questions.
So Sasi's talking about the amount of error we see in experiments and how much we see in models that tend to be exact. Well, models are exact in what they know, but not what they don't know. And the experiments are sort of exact in what they tell us, but not too exact in what they don't tell us. And so I think the thing is, it's a matter of doing a lot of it. You have to you can't just rely on one or two experiments. You have to go out and do quite a bit of them. And also, there's a certain amount, sometimes a model can tell us something, and maybe that the experiment doesn't if we run them together, and maybe we're missing something. So the thing is to lower your expectations about how well the model should predict the thing, and also to look at what the do more of the more of the comparisons. Does that answer the question?
You can't go anywhere. We have 6 minutes.
Oh, I let it go tonight.
Well, you can continue talking about your data.
What?
I have too early in the morning to formulate questions, huh?
Well, the model itself is Sally, go ahead. Well, the thing is how they, we're working on a diffusive model of root growth, and that would be more and less sensitive to the size of the elements. So the element size, because it's a finite element model, the element sizes can go from like half a centimeter down to 10, 15 centimeters. And so that kind of distorts what the root density is in a layer and how that root density moves from one element to another. And I think moving to either a vector-based root model or one that's more purely diffusive-based would help us with that. It works really well if you have your if all your elements are about the same size. But if they're not the same size, it doesn't work very well. And the model itself is available on GitHub if you're interested. We've shared it open. I have data there. We update it with the versions. Look for GitHub Mesim.
Good question.
And Gert had a question.
Gert.
Yeah, you made a statement that you envision models we don't have to calibrate.
I'm sorry?
That you envision models we don't have to calibrate.
Well, that's where the calibration would be species differences. But once you calibrate the species for one location, you shouldn't have to calibrate it for another. What I'm saying is there's a lot of our models, we have built in sort of some environmental dependencies because of the way we calibrate them and develop them. And how can we minimize those environmental dependencies? And a lot of the data on MaySim we fit from growth chamber data and also the literature. So, for example, the photosynthesis model is a Farquhar Barberi model of carbon assimilation, and we fit the data with the literature and also with our growth chamber data, and that seems to work pretty well in all the couple of places we've tested it. I have another paper that I had a visiting scientist from Peru work on. We compared some data from Kansas from syntheses, and Mesim worked pretty well for those sites without doing any calibration on them. I mean, it's kind of a pipe dream in many ways, but I think that what part of it is accepting that you're not going to get a perfect simulation every time, and you want to see what the dynamics are and how it can work with you. And part of it is to understand how we can program the models to make them less dependent. For example, growing degree days can be very dependent on location because they vary a lot with the mean temperature that you observe them at. And using something like a thermal a beta function for a non-thermal relationship for temperature can then give you something that's with a rate as a function of temperature itself at that hour. And those data can be moved from, say, a growth chamber environment to the field. And we've worked with those things levels.